This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News podcasting to you from Sausalito. Today's topic is that of growth hormone deficiency, but in particular of a new stimulation test for growth hormone deficiency. And for lack of a better word, we're calling it the macrolin stimulation test. And for those of you who want to look that up, it's macrilen. This is a new peptide produced by Strong Bridge Biopharma. And we'll get to that later, but first let's talk about growth hormone release from the pituitary gland.
Before we move on, a quick announcement to remind our listeners, this is an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Let's continue.
Growth hormone is produced by the somatotroph cells of the anterior pituitary gland. It's regulated by the hypothalamus. The predominant influencer of growth hormone secretion is somatostatin, which exerts a negative effect on growth hormone secretion. And somatostatin is the major, if you will, tone or the major influencer of growth hormone secretion. And think of it as the fact that it's always being suppressed. Growth hormone is always being suppressed by somatostatin. Growth hormone release then occurs in response to growth hormone releasing hormone produced by the anterior pituitary gland. And this occurs in pulses. GHRH is secreted probably mostly at nighttime, and that leads to the fact that we have our nocturnal or nighttime pulses of growth hormone. In fact, most growth hormone made by adults is produced at nighttime while we're sleeping. Another peptide that probably has a positive effect is ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N. It's going to bind to the growth hormone secretagogue receptor, known as the ghrelin receptor, and also increases growth hormone secretion in mammals. As you know, once growth hormone is secreted, it circulates and is bound to proteins and is free and does its own thing, binding to its receptors, and that leads to IGF-1 production by the liver, which does its own thing. It circulates bound to proteins as well. Some of it's free. And the clinical effects of growth hormone are as a consequence of not only the growth hormone itself, but also the IGF-1 levels. And IGF-1, we know, does negatively feed back on this system process and probably leads to increased somatostatin tone and decreases growth hormone releasing hormone.
Interesting. It's always amazing to me how complicated and interrelated all of this chemistry is. It makes me wonder the research and investigation that scientists undertook to learn how all of this works. Now let's listen to Dr. Blevins talk about diagnostic testing for growth hormone deficiency.
Diagnostic testing for growth hormone deficiency. This is something that has been in evolution the entire time that I've been seeing patients with endocrine disorders, and that would be dating back to about 1990. So nearly 30 years. And I've been able to follow the progress of diagnostic testing over time. It used to be that we treated children with growth hormone deficiency with growth hormone, but not adults. And for children, you could do a number of things to test them, run them up and down the stairs, give them L-DOPA, give them clonidine, insulin-induced hypoglycemia. We didn't really worry much about adults until growth hormone became commercially available as produced in the laboratory through recombinant DNA technologies, and we started assessing growth hormone deficiency in patients with a history of pituitary disease, finding out that treatment actually made significant improvements in their overall quality of life and other markers and measures of health. And we've gone into those topics in other podcasts. Early on, we were doing testing such as insulin-induced hypoglycemia, L-DOPA, clonidine tests, and we found out that some of these tests didn't work in adults. And ultimately, we sort of evolved our testing through a number of different research studies that evaluated diagnostic tests in patients with growth hormone deficiency. and found that the arginine and growth hormone releasing hormone test is probably as close as you can get to the gold standard insulin-induced hypoglycemia test and get away with doing a test that doesn't have the associated risks of insulin-induced hypoglycemia. So a number of us used that test as our diagnostic test of choice until growth hormone releasing hormone was withdrawn from the market and no longer manufactured for whatever reason. I don't even recall the particular reasons now. Afterwards, additional studies were done and we largely migrated to the glucagon stimulation test, which has been the workhorse in my clinic to diagnose growth hormone deficiency. It's a reasonable test. It might not have the best sensitivity and specificity in obese patients, but it's a pretty good test to diagnose growth hormone deficiency. It does require an injection and it takes 3 to 4 hours, so it can be cumbersome. Recently, however, probably first in 2013, was the publication of a substance, massimerelin, which is a ghrelin agonist or secretagogue that secretes growth hormone by binding to the ghrelin receptor. It was evaluated and reported in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism as a new potential growth hormone test. And in that particular study, they evaluated patients who had growth hormone deficiency and healthy matched controls, and a number of people who had previously been, I believe, on growth hormone who'd been diagnosed with growth hormone deficiency as well. And they found that giving this substance led to a significant increase in growth hormone in the control groups. The average was 17.7 plus or minus 19.11 nanograms per milliliter as far as the growth hormone response was concerned. And then patients with growth hormone deficiency had a level that was much less than that, an average of 2.36 plus or minus 5.69 nanogram per milliliter. And when they did all the statistical analysis and different cutoffs, etc., they found that different cutoffs for non-obese and obese subjects were such that you saw fairly reputable sensitivity and specificity and misclassification rates. For example, they found that using the cutoff of 2.7 nanogram per milliliter with the macrolin stimulation test, it was an 82% sensitivity, 92% specificity, and a 13% misclassification rate comparing to the arginine and growth hormone releasing hormone stimulation test. They found that if they used a cutoff of 6.8 for non-obese and 2.7 for obese subjects, had a misclassification rate of 11%. So this study was important. You know, it certainly didn't give us a careful idea about the specifics of this particular test. It was not compared against the gold standard, with insulin-induced hypoglycemia being the gold standard that I had mentioned. But it certainly suggested that this particular agent might be a useful growth hormone stimulant in the evaluation of patients who might have growth hormone deficiency. So exciting, and certainly requiring further study.
Statistics. Particularly in this setting, sound very, very complex. So now, let's listen to Dr. Blevins explain how to decide the strength or accuracy of a new diagnostic test.
Statistics. And I sigh for a reason. Never been one of my favorite subjects, but it's a necessary evil in the field of medicine. I actually enjoy it to some extent, but it's interesting. Statistics evolves just as rapidly and regularly as does the practice of medicine. You've all heard of mean and median and mode and standard deviations, etc. But it becomes actually rather more complex the deeper you get into medical research, and also trying to understand how to evaluate the adequacy, efficacy, strength, accuracy, etc. of a new diagnostic test. The first thing you need to know is that you have to have a gold standard test to compare it against. We call it the gold standard because that's, you know, the reference to how our money is sort of measured. But there truly is no perfect test or no perfect gold standard even, because even some patients with growth hormone deficiency probably fail the gold standard or pass the gold standard test, for example. And some patients who do not have growth hormone deficiency probably fail the gold standard test. It's all dependent on operator performance and the degree of hypoglycemia during the test, et cetera, et cetera. It even varies depending on the assay that's used to assess for growth hormone deficiency. So with that said, there is a gold standard, and tests should be compared against a gold standard or a test that's been compared to the gold standard and suggests that it's a reasonable particular test. The second thing you need to know is that the sensitivity and specificity are different things. Sensitivity is sort of the ability to pick up a disease if it exists, and the specificity is how specific it is for the disease, and that if you have an abnormal test result, how accurate or how reliable is that particular result? Are there other things that could cause that, for example, that aren't related to having the actual disease? You may have heard of true positive and false positive and things like that. All that relates. Probably the most critical piece of all of this is what I refer to and what many others have referred to as the pretest probability of having a disease. And this sort of gets into what we call Bayesian statistics. And it relates to the fact that if you have a pretest probability of having a disease, the test results are more likely to be accurate. The classic case series that's evaluated to look at this is that of a treadmill test for heart disease, for example. So if your pretest probability of having heart disease is low, such as your 20-year-old woman, for example, who has some nonspecific chest pain, and you have the exercise treadmill test, the likelihood that an abnormal result is really abnormal is pretty low. There are going to be a lot of false positive results there, a lot of sort of erroneous results, if you will. But if you're a 70-year-old man who has smoked tobacco and has diabetes mellitus and a history of hypertension, your pretest probability is high, and an abnormal test result on that exercise treadmill probably really is abnormal. Well, the same thing applies to patients who have pituitary disease and undergo any diagnostic tests that we do, but especially the growth hormone stimulation test. We know that if you have a pituitary tumor or pituitary surgery or whatever, or pituitary abnormality on MRI, the likelihood that you have growth hormone deficiency is about 60%. So you can say the pretest probability is 60%. We know that if you simply got an IGF-1 level because you were tired or fatigued and you have an MRI of the pituitary and it's normal, your pretest probability of growth hormone deficiency is probably pretty low. Any diagnostic test for growth hormone deficiency is going to be more accurate, if you will, with positives really being positives and not false positives, and negatives really being negatives and not false negatives, if you have a pituitary tumor or surgery or other disease process, see if your pretest probability of disease is high. Now, I practice medicine this way all the time, and I think about patients. If they have a negative MRI and a low IGF-1, they're probably going to have a normal stimulation test. But if they have an empty sella and a low IGF-1, their pretest probability is a little higher. And an abnormal test results probably really more likely to truly be abnormal. If they have a history of two pituitary operations, I'm going to see that the accuracy of that test is going to be much greater. So that's how we think about statistics. When we start talking about comparing a test to a gold standard, we use a number of different techniques, including receiver operator characteristic curve analysis, which is able to find the best combination of sensitivity and specificity to sort of maximize the cutoff, if you will, choose the cutoff. And it's able to compare the accuracy of a test to a gold standard, for example. So another way of evaluating a test is more cumbersome and complex, and it's really looking at negative and positive agreements between a test and an insulin-induced hypoglycemia test. In other words, to summarize it and make it simple, looking at whether two results are in agreement with one another or disparate.
Well, I think a more accurate description of this subject would be super, super complex, maybe, no? But going back to it, it makes me wonder if the macrolide test has ever been studied in that manner. So let's listen as Dr. Blevins gets to the meat of this podcast.
Well, in 2018, just this year, Garcia and others published a paper looking at the macromorelin as a diagnostic test for adult growth hormone deficiency, and they actually looked at this test compared to the gold standard test, the insulin-induced hypoglycemia test, and I applaud them for that particular analysis. They also looked at the negative and positive agreements between the stimulation tests and insulin-induced hypoglycemia. They looked at sensitivity and specificity pairs, and you know, worked on sliding the cutoff up and down to try to find the best combinations, etc. So I was really happy to see this paper, and also with the way they had conducted the research. And I think it really is up there as one of the seminal papers on the proper way to evaluate a new diagnostic test. So what they did is they had patients who had either a high, intermediate, or low likelihood for growth hormone deficiency. So again, they're thinking pretest probability. And they looked at matched controls. They had a total of about 38 high, 37 intermediate, and 39 low likelihood growth hormone deficient patients. And the healthy controls were 25 people. Maybe they should have included more controls in this particular study. At least that would be my only criticism if I were asked to review this particular paper. The way this test is done is it's an oral solution. How about that? We have an oral drug that stimulates growth hormone release. I think that's particularly awesome and avoids the placement in IV or injection into a muscle or what have you. The other nice thing about this drug is that you get a fairly robust response to it if you're normal, and it turns out you can check growth hormone levels at 0, 30, 45, 60, and 90 minutes, then you're done. No more three-hour testing. So that's excellent. It's a time saver. It's oral. Less of a problem than other methods of testing for growth hormone deficiency. Now, just to basically skip to the meat of the results, they basically found that if you used a cut point of 5.1 nanogram per milliliter, the negative agreement between the tests was 94% roughly. The positive agreement was 82%. And to summarize, those are good numbers. So, you know, they had a sliding scale for the cut points, or the cutoff, if you will. And 5.1 seemed to be the best cutoff, I think, for the sensitivity and specificity for this new test, which were 92% and 96%, respectively. Using a lower cutoff, you had a lower sensitivity, but the specificity was the same. So they were able to slide that cut off up to 5.1, and I really appreciate that, because I think that some of these diagnostic tests use a cutoff level that's too low in a patient population that has a high pretest probability. And I wonder whether we would push that cutoff a little higher. When I look at their data, I think a cutoff of maybe 5.5 would be an even better cutoff to provide a good combination of sensitivity and specificity, especially in a group of people that we're evaluating who probably do have growth hormone deficiency.
Before we continue with Dr. Blevins' discussion on using the new macrolide test, I wanted to take a few minutes to mention a few important things. Pituitary World News is just the two of us, Dr. Blevins and I. Thanks to the generous donation from our key supporters, We've been able to do our work and retain a web expert to help us keep the site and social media channels safe and working very efficiently. It really takes more than full time to manage the site, write the articles, research the content, record, edit, produce, and publish the podcast. And we are constantly searching for new ways of reaching more people in the hope that this knowledge will lead to more interest in pituitary disease from the general public and therefore shorter times to diagnosis. But we need your help because what we get is just isn't enough. So if you enjoy what we're doing, please chip in and help us keep doing it. If you think about it and you give us a few dollars every time you listen to a podcast, download a brochure, or read an article, it's enough to make a world of difference. We have a long list of initiatives we'd like to implement, initiatives that we know will make a difference to our effort. We work very efficiently and we can do this with small amounts, but your support will really help. If you'd like to donate, any amount is truly appreciated. Please go to pituitaryworldnews.org and click on the Get Involved button at the top of the front page to get to our donations page. Your donation is fully tax deductible. And if you'd like to learn about our list of initiatives and plans, please send us a note through our social media channels or email and we'll get the list to you. Many of you have already helped, and we are truly thankful for that. Thank you for your time. Now let's continue with this very informational podcast from Dr. Blevins on this new macrolide test.
I'm not using this test in my practice as of yet. It's been available for probably 2 to 3 months now or so. It's not easy to get. We are in the process now of trying to work out the logistics at our institution. This is not a drug that a patient can go pick up at a pharmacy and then bring to the doctor's office for testing. It has to be on ice. It's probably going to have to be shipped to our institution and other institutions, and of course you need to figure out who's going to receive it, take it off ice, put it in a refrigerator or whatever until the patient's ready to come in for testing. So there's going to be some storage issues. There's going to be pre-authorizations required and probably third-party pharmacies involved. The drug's going to be rather costly. I suspect that we're going to have some denials and we'll have to go ahead with a glucagon stimulation test. But we are working very hard at UCSF to get the gears put in place so that the wheels turn so that patients can be tested using the macrolide stimulation test. Now, this is going to probably involve deciding that a patient needs to have testing, writing a prescription, filling out papers to get an authorization. It runs up through the insurance company, ultimately to a specialty pharmacy who will probably ship it to UCSF. Once it's approved, it'll get shipped. The patient will be scheduled. They'll come in. They'll take the solution in front of a nurse who will then draw the blood at the appropriate intervals. The patient will go home and will have results within a week and probably get patients on testing. My approach is that if I have results that are sort of close to normal or not quite there or equivocal or not what's expected, that we'll probably either repeat the test or do a glucagon stimulation test. But I think this is going to be a test that we'll be using in fairly short order, and hopefully the skids will be greased or all the cogs will be put in place so that endocrinologists at other centers and other communities, centers or hospitals or practices will also be able to offer this test to their patients. As usual, it's my pleasure to do these podcasts and to share new knowledge and useful knowledge with our listeners. And as usual, if you have any questions or comments, please send them our way and we'll try to get to those. If you have other recommendations about podcasts, please submit those recommendations or requests, and we'll do our best to create something useful so that you can learn more about pituitary disease and be more engaged in your healthcare.